Well, thanks very much for everybody for being here, and thanks, like everybody else has said, to Scott and Randy for the invitation to present at what I think is going to be a really, and already has been a really fantastic question or session. I want to start by acknowledging the fact that what I'm going to talk about today really represents work not just from my lab, but from a bunch of collaborative labs. This is work that's taking place just down the road at Chapman University, but I'm also working really closely with Scott Bridgham at the University of Oregon, Jeff Chanton and his laboratory at Florida State University, and Joel Kafka and his laboratory at the Georgia Institute of Technology. And I start with that to sort of give me the caveat to say that that means at best I understand about 10% of what I'm going to talk about today. So, you know, just be aware of that. What we've been working on in sort of this collaborative interdisciplinary group is trying to understand anaerobic carbon cycling, and in particular methane cycling in peatland ecosystems, and really trying to get at this idea of, can we go in and look at a site that we call a bog, and just by being able to say that we call a site a bog, does that tell us anything about how that site actually works? Do we know anything about anaerobic carbon cycling? Do we know anything about methane biogeochemistry just because we think we've set foot in a bog? So we've seen a couple great talks that have given a really nice introduction to the fact that peatland ecosystems are important in the global carbon cycle. We know that they store lots and lots of carbon. We also know that they release lots of methane, so something like one-third of the terrestrial soil carbon locked up in peatland ecosystems, and they're responsible for a significant but poorly constrained fraction of the 15 to 40% of the methane that's released into the atmosphere every year by wetland ecosystems. We know, however, that there are different types of peatlands on the landscape, and peatland ecologists tend to think about the different types of peatlands on the landscape along this ombrotrophic to mineratrophic hydrogeomorphic gradient. At the mineratrophic end of this gradient, we find rich fens. These are peatland ecosystems that receive surface and groundwater inputs. This gives them a relatively circumneutral soil pH of around 6. They generally have higher nutrient availability, and they have a very specific plant community that dominates in these ecosystems. These tend to be graminoid herb-dominated ecosystems. At the ombrotrophic end of this gradient, we find what we consider bogs, right? These are ecosystems that are more hydrologically isolated. They only receive their hydrologic inputs from the atmosphere. This gives them a relatively acidic soil pH. Typically, soil pHs in these bog ecosystems are around 4. And again, a very specific plant community. These are ecosystems that are dominated by sphagnum mosses, as well as a few ericaceous shrubs and things like black spruce and some sedges. We know that these ecosystems differ, right? And if we take a really broad perspective on this hydrogeomorphic gradient, on this ombrotrophic mineratrophic gradient, we know, and perhaps we're not surprised by the fact, that they're really different. We know that bogs act differently than rich fens. What we've been trying to explore in a little bit more depth is what happens if you're just at one end of this gradient. What happens if you're just working within bog ecosystems, sphagnum-dominated, low pH ecosystems? What's the variability look like at that end of this gradient? And can we begin to add some mechanism to explain the variability that we see? Right, and this, I'm never going to have the chance to do this, so just indulge me. My title comes from Shakespeare, and I'm really proud of that, right? So we know that Romeo and Juliet has this line, you know, right, what's in a name, that which we call a rose, by any other name would smell just as sweet. And I was really proud of myself for this. So look, this is a peatland biogeochemistry talk, and I have Shakespeare on the screen, and I think I should be able to take 10 seconds and just revel in that. Like any good biogeochemist, I wanted to make sure that I actually have the allusion right, so I went to Wikipedia, and I do, right? So this quote of a rose by any other name or a bog by any other name is really asking this question of what do we mean when we call something a bog? And simply by naming a peatland a bog, do we know anything about what's happening with the biogeochemistry? And I think it matters, right? So our work is really motivated by work that we're going to be doing at the Spruce site. We've heard about this a couple of times already. It's this really just absurdly cool project run by the DOE and the Forest Service, where we have a bog in northern Minnesota. This is the S1 bog that Steve just talked about. We're going to have these big 12-meter chambers in there. They're manipulating air temperature, they're manipulating soil temperature, and they're manipulating atmospheric carbon dioxide. It's going to be super cool, and we're going to learn a ton about this bog. Prior to the start of this experiment, one of the questions we've been asking is just how representative is this bog, right? A lot of the Spruce project is motivated by modelers who are going to take the results from S1 bog and then take the total area of bogs on the landscape, and then they're just going to multiply those things together. And we're really trying to question whether or not that's the appropriate approach. Can we just assume that what's happening at S1 is going to happen in every other bog? How representative of S1 How representative of bogs on the landscape is S1 bog? So we've taken a comparative approach to this. So we're doing some work in S1. This is mostly work that I'm, the work that I'm going to present today is work at S1 bog that's taken place outside of the chambers. So this has nothing to do with that large scale climate manipulation. This is all work that's just sort of background information on the bog site. This is what this site looks like, right? Or what the understory at the site looks like. It's sphagnum dominated. It has a pH of just below 4. You've got this 100% cover by sphagnum mosses. You have the presence of a small number of graminoids, some forbs and some shrubs, but it's very much a sphagnum dominated site that I think all of us would walk into and say, yes, this looks like a bog. The water table diagram, which is up here, this is just a box plot showing water table depth along the soil surface. We ran a couple hundred points along transects to get this, just to show that there is some topography at this site. It's a hummock hollow dominated bog ecosystem. The hummocks are relatively high. They can be 30 or 40 centimeters above the hollows, and the average water table depth is somewhere around negative 20 centimeters when we made these measurements. Okay, so this is S1 bog, the site that this large cool spruce experiment is going to focus on. We wanted to compare S1 bog to Bog Lake Fen. Now, admittedly, the word fen is in the name of this site, so we know it's not a true bog, but it sort of looks like a bog, right? If you just walked into Bog Lake Fen and you didn't have Steve Sebastian with you who could tell you about the hydrology of the site, you would look at this site and say, well, it has a pH of just under 4 or just above 4. It's got a virtually complete ground layer of sphagnum mosses. This looks kind of boggy, right? You know, does this act anything like the S1 bog? The water table here is, of course, really different. It doesn't have near the microtopography. It's much more of a lawn-dominated ecosystem with the water table relatively close to a relatively flat soil surface. And then the third site that we're going to compare is a site called Zim Bog. It's not located in Marcel. It's about 30 miles away. It's in very close to the Meadowlands sites where Evan collected his peat for the Musicosm experiment at Michigan Tech. Again, this is a sphagnum-dominated site. Really looks like a bog, right? Low pH, around 3.5, 3.6, something like that. And with a different water table structure here as well. This essentially looks like one giant hummock, right? Most of the soil surface here is well above the water table. The water table here is 35, 40 centimeters below the soil surface. You do have some hollows that go relatively deep, but this is a much less topographically variable site and looks much more like one big hummock. Okay, so those are our three sites. I think they're all bogs or boggy ecosystems, and we really want to see if we can understand how these things work, right? Do they look anything like each other when we're starting to talk about carbon biogeochemistry or when we're starting to talk about methane dynamics? So the first data that I'm going to show you are just some flux measurements that we have. So this is just net flux measurement. This is done with little small static chambers in each of these different sites, but gives us the starting point to explore what's going on with biogeochemistry. We've measured these things multiple times over the past year. Here's what net flux looks like from these three different sites. Bog Lake Fen in red, S1 Bog in black, and Zim Bog in blue here. And what you can see is that there's some temporal variability, as you might expect, right? But what's more important and more interesting to us is these sites look really different, right? S1 bog has relatively high methane flux here. S1 bog's methane flux actually looks like a poor fen, Bog Lake Fen right next door. Contrast that to Zim Bog, this other sphagnum-dominated low pH site that we would all walk into and say, yep, it's another bog, where the methane flux is virtually zero pretty consistently across this entire time period. A lot of that low methane flux in Zim Bog is driven by water table level. Recall that that's a much drier site, a site that looks much more like a hummock. But we can begin to show that this low methane flux, we can begin to unravel some mechanisms here. So we also measure the isotopes of methane that comes out in those chamber experiments, right? This is just a plot showing del-13 carbon versus del-deuterium. And what you'll notice here is that the Zim Bog site, this relatively dry site that has relatively zero methane flux, has a very, very strong methane oxidation signal. So we begin to put some mechanism behind this difference that we see between the net methane flux. What's been really cool to us, or to me, maybe not, well, probably to all of us, but certainly to me, what I think is cool is that this biogeochemistry matches up really nicely with some of the molecular approaches that Joel Costa has been doing. So these are measurements of particulate methane monooxygenase, PMLA, which is the gene responsible for methane oxidation. It's used by methanotrophs. right? Joel can look at this, and his postdoc can look at this as gene copy or transcript, so they can look at the presence of methanotrophs. They can also look at the activity of methanotrophs. And they summarize those two things in this following graph here. So this is the ratio of PMOA transcript to gene ratio, so the activity to presence ratio of this methane oxidizing group of bacteria. And what we see here is that there's a nice story coming together, right? Zimbog, which is this very hummocky, relatively dry site, has low methane flux. The methane looks like it's been very oxidized, and the microbial community suggests that there is a very active methanotroph community that indeed is at play at Zimbog. So much higher transcript to gene ratios for PMOA at Zimbog than we see at either of the other two sites. Right, suggesting that what might be happening at Zimbog is this high rate of methane oxidation, but we can begin to put some mechanism behind this. That is going to be the end of any sort of cohesive story that I have. And in the rest of the talk, what I'm going to do is look at the other side of methane dynamics, and that's particularly methane production, where things are not nearly as neat and clean, and try and start to see how these sites differ and where they're similar when we look at methane production. And I think that for me, this part is much more fun. It's much more sort of exploratory. We don't have the story totally sewn up. I'm going to be throwing out some ideas, but the big picture punchline here is that it's really complicated, and that sometimes these sites look like they should be really similar, but we know they're not acting similar. Sometimes they look like they should be acting really differently, and they end up acting really similarly. So I'm just going to start with this graph here. This is a graph showing actual rates of in situ methane production. This is a depth profile here. So we're going from surface peat down to peat that's about 2 meters below the soil surface in our three sites. Okay? And we see some differences. So Bog Lake Fen, the site that doesn't have a whole lot of methane oxidation, it has the highest net methane flux, also has generally the highest rates of in situ methane production throughout the depth profile. S1 Bog, which has comparably high rates of net methane flux, doesn't look like that methane is getting oxidized, has very, very high rates of methane production in the soil surface, but as we go down with depth, it starts to look much more like Zimbog, very low rates of methane production. And Zimbog, this site where we wanted to explain net methane flux by the fact that it was highly oxidized, also has very low rates of methane production throughout the soil profile, right? So we need to think about both sides of this methane equation here. So what drives this? Why are these sites acting differently at the surface? Why are these sites acting similarly at depth? One of the things that surprised me a little bit, but I think is an interesting thing to keep in mind, is that part of this could be relatively simple. Part of this is just the fact that these sites have very different in situ temperatures. This presence of this large, deep, unsaturated sphagnum mat at Zimbog, this very hummocky Zimbog, has this big mat of relatively dense sphagnum on it, and that just acts like a really great insulator. So Zimbog, in the same sampling dates in July of 2013, is just much colder than these other two sites. So maybe just the presence of this high sphagnum hummock changes on temperature helps explain why we see such low rates of methane production at this site. We also can look at pore water isotopes. So this is the fractionation factor of 13 carbon DIC over 13 carbon methane, right? And this ratio tells us something about the dominant pathway of methane production that we can measure in the field at these various sites. So these are depth profiles again, the fractionation factor on our horizontal axis here. And we have these data collected across the growing season in 2013. And we start to see some interesting patterns that are emerging here as well, right? In the surface, we tend to see more acetoclastic methanogenesis, so lower fractionation factors, right? And that pattern holds broadly across all sites, but it's particularly pronounced at Bog Lake Fen, where we tend to see a stronger signal of acetoclastic methanogenesis throughout the depth profile. So maybe part of the reason why we see these different rates of methane production and different fluxes of methane to the atmosphere has to do with not only temperature driven by the presence of this hummock, but also different methanogenic pathways that are dominating at these different sites. We can also ask questions about carbon quality. So is it methanogenic microbial community and methanogenic pathway, or is it substrate quality? So this is some work. Is that some sort of it's like, it's right. That's a sign, right? You're done. Peace out. So I'll just talk loudly, which is fine. So this is some work done at Jeff Chanton's lab in Florida. We're looking at SUVA here on pore water. So SUVA, of course, for those of you that don't know, and I suspect many of you do, gives you an indication of the quality of dissolved organic matter. And then the graph on the right is some mass spec work looking at humification of the solid phase peat. And what we can see is that we see differences in carbon quality here, right? So S1 tends to have more labile, more juicy, Bog Lake Fen, the red dots, tends to be less humified, tends to have lower SUVA values. The microbes in Bog Lake Fen are just having access to a much juicier substrate than the microbes at these other two sites. Maybe this helps explain some of the differences. What's interesting to me here is that look at S1 and Zimbog on these graphs. These two sites that have different rates of net methane flux, and certainly in the surface have very different rates of in situ methane production, have very similar carbon quality based on these two metrics, right? So not any one of these things helps explain. There's no clear story here. So can this be important? Yes. May it explain why Bog Lake Fen looks different? Yes. But does it explain why S1 and Zim are looking really different from each other? I don't think so. There's a different layer of complexity that we need to consider here. We also have some molecular approaches here. This is again done by Joel Koska and his group. We're looking now at the transcript to gene ratio of the MCRA gene. This is the gene that's used by methanogens to make methane. And unlike the methane oxidation, the methanotroph story, where we see some really nice connections to that methanotroph activity as it links back to rates of methane oxidation in the field, we don't see that here. Bog Lake Fen, our site that has the highest rates of methane production, has the lowest ratio of transcript to gene abundance, right? S1 Bog and Zim Bog are sites that don't have particularly high rates of methane production actually show higher activity by the methanogenic community. So in this case, we actually have a disconnect between the molecular biology and the biogeochemical measurements that we have. The other thing that's turned out to be sort of interesting for us is when we look at potential methane production, the whole story falls apart, right? So this is cumulative methane production over a long-term anaerobic laboratory experiment done at sort of idealized conditions. So we ran these things for 6 months at 18 degrees in the laboratory here, right? And what you see is that these site differences are much less clear here. So S1 Bog is the black dots again. It's sort of intermediate. Bog Lake Fen still has the highest rates of potential methane production. But look at Zim Bog, right? The site that has very, very low net methane flux, the site that has almost no rates of in situ methane production, it can make methane just fine. It can make methane at rates comparable to S1 Bog, but it's not doing so in the field. Right? So why is that? What's going on there? I ask, but I have no answer. I think it's really interesting and something that we need to think about. So I think I'm at my 20-minute mark or so. So let me kind of wrap up with a few concluding thoughts here. I think that what we've tried to do here is say that just by naming something a bog does not tell us anything about the biogeochemistry of that site. You can walk into these sphagnum-dominated, low pH ecosystems that we all would agree are bogs, or certainly very, very boggy. Just by being able to name it a bog does not tell you anything about how it actually works, right? The biogeochemistry, and in particular the methane biogeochemistry, is much more complex than that. And I think there are some important implications of that, right? It means that you can't run a really super cool experiment like Spruce and assume that every other bog in the entire universe is going to act just like Spruce. You need a stronger mechanistic understanding if you're really going to try and model these methane dynamics across a complex landscape that includes lots of these different types of bog ecosystems. We compared these three sites. Eswan Bog, the home of the spruce experiment, Bog Lake Fen, a very boggy poor fen, and Zim Bog, a truly ombotrophic, hummock-dominated ecosystem, and they just work really differently. I think we were able to show that there's some nice connections between the biogeochemistry associated with methane oxidation and the microbial communities responsible for methane oxidation, and to show that that methane oxidation can be a key driver of net methane flux in the field. When we looked at the anaerobic side of this, when we looked at methane production, the mechanisms are much more muddled, much more complicated, and much more fun. We know that it's probably related to simple things like temperature, but we know that it can also be driven by soil carbon quality, dissolved organic matter carbon quality, methane activity, and the dominant pathway of methane production in these various ecosystems. There's a lot of work to be done here. We're excited to do it. I think I have a couple minutes for questions, and I'm happy to take those if there's time. Yes, please.
Yeah. I'm curious. I like the pattern of the different three different sort of sphagnum-dominated systems and the way the questions you asked.
Thanks.
But I didn't hear you talk about the different species of sphagnum. All three of those are dominated by three different species of sphagnum. As Merrick Tereski showed some years back, is the chemistry of those different species is very different. So the substrate quality that those microbes would have would be largely controlled by the chemistry of the different species of sphagnum. So maybe you're different. Instead of calling them all bogs, maybe we should be calling them sphagnum fuscum dominated, sphagnum angustifolium dominated, and so on systems.
Yeah, it's a really great point. And, you know, Merritt's done some amazing work on this, right? And we know that this is a way that we can begin to approach these things at a landscape scale. I'd be really curious to talk to modelers about how realistic that looks for them. Are there ways that we can do this spectrally to drive the models that way? And there probably are. We've done some work on this actually specifically where we've looked at the leachate from these different sphagnums at these different sites. And we've shown that that leachate cannot drive the biogeochemistry. So there's some sites, the spuscum-dominated site at Zimbog, which has very, very low rates of methane production. And one of our ideas is this just due to the sphagnum chemistry? And we particularly looked at the sphagnum leachate. And what we show is that you can take the leachate from Zimbog with low methane production and you can feed it to the other sites, and they're able to take it and they're able to mineralize it and they're able to convert it to methane just fine. Conversely, you can take the leachate from Bog Lake Fen, right, it's making methane, it's perfectly happy to make methane. You give that leachate to the soils from Zimbog, they can't do anything with it. So I think that there's definitely, and acknowledging that leachate and soil substrate are very different things and that sphagnum can influence both of those things, I think that there's more complexity to it than just saying it's sphagnum. Right, which is cool, right? But that's certainly a piece of it, and not so in the same way that not all bogs are the same, not all sphagnum is the same, and I think it's a really great point that we are trying to consider in our thinking. Do I have time? Good.
Comment followed by a question. You use the term site and ecosystem interchangeably in your presentation, and one of your sites actually had the names of two different ecosystems.
Three. Bog Lake and Fen.
Ah, great. And my question is whether you're able to take advantage of any work done on ecosystem classification and mapping on the Marcel, soil mapping as well, perhaps, to define sites that are ecosystems rather than approaching from more of a plant.
Just looking at the vegetation sphagnum-dominated community?
Yeah.
I think we could. And to be really honest, this project would be made better the more sites that we could include, right? And I know that I could talk to Steve and say, give me a list of all the bogs, or Randy, give me a list of all the things that you think are true bogs at Marcel, right? And you could get that for all of northern Minnesota. And doing more and more of a comparative approach would give you more and more perspective on this project. We didn't do that. We'd love to move to that place. We've done some of those bigger comparisons with a smaller subset of some of these things, but we were just trying to compare three sphagnum-dominated systems that, you know, how boggy is boggy? Can we begin to unravel some of the mechanisms that explain those differences? But moving forward, it's a great idea, and it's a great suggestion and something that we should be thinking about, especially with the data set that they have at Marcel. Does that answer? Not really.
Well, thank you.
But I'm happy to chat more about how you would approach it and how to do it better.
I don't have any suggestions.
Well, think of some and then come tell me them later, because I'm happy to hear them. Am I good?
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Great. Thanks very much.